That's his signal to know that we're starting the War College officially here at CelestaCon. Thank you, everyone, for coming. My name is Dana Lombardi, and I am helping to put together the War College this year and next year as well. We have a whole bunch of people talking on really interesting subjects, and tonight my talk is going to be about the Battle of Kursk, the real story behind it. There are a lot of myths about Kursk, and Kursk is very famous as supposedly the largest tank battle of World War II. Technically, that's correct if you include all the area around Kursk, not just the narrow area where the fighting did occur, but including all the tanks from all the armies in the adjoining areas where the Soviets then launched a counterattack. And in fact, that's one of the first myths, is the fact that we only read mostly the German perspective about the battle, which means we're looking at what they did in their planning, what their arguments were, what they achieved, what they were hoping to achieve, and what their failure was. What's left off in many of the books is that right after the Germans stopped advancing, the Soviets launched a huge counterattack that not only swept back all the territory the Germans had taken, but took a lot more territory, hundreds of miles more. And this was done the month after the Germans had stopped their offensive. And this is usually not talked about, but that was not just thrown together. It wasn't an ad hoc type offensive. The Soviets had been planning this, and it was the first time where they accepted not only the defensive responsibility and the planning, but they planned for an immediate offensive, a counteroffensive, to be part of the operation. Why is this important? Because in 1941 and 1942, the Soviets had major offensives, but they were during the winter. In other words, they had a big counterattack at Moscow in 1941 when the Germans were stopped by the weather. And then in 1942, in the winter, they encircled the German 6th Army, and they tried to encircle the Panzer Group, or the Army Group Center, around Moscow. And that didn't work. The one in Stalingrad, everyone knows the 6th Army was encircled and destroyed, and that caused the Germans to get into 1943, trying to figure out, okay, how do we maintain the initiative against the Soviets? Well, the Soviets are thinking the same thing, and because a lot of the records, a lot of the memoirs, and a lot of the things that the Russians wrote either were restricted by the Soviet government or it wasn't translated into English, we got the German perspective on most of the battles, most of the fighting, including Kursk. So what we have to do to balance that picture is to look at what the Soviets were doing, and they were going through major changes in 43 that were going to enable them not only to win this battle, but to go on and continue to have offensive after offensive after offensive all the way to Berlin in 1945. They would never surrender the initiative. The Germans would never be able to get it again. And this is the Germans' last opportunity to take the initiative back on the Eastern Front and try and stabilize the war, at least from the standpoint of the current military forces. Hitler was trying to adopt super weapons, secret weapons, the vengeance weapons. They had rockets, they had jets, they had their own nuclear program that he had talked about. It was not as far along as ours, but again, he was hoping that he could buy time to have these weapons come into the war that would be a game changer for him. I don't think that Hitler or the Germans thought that they were going to outproduce the Allies when they were fighting so many different nations. Germany was up against Great Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union as the big nations, and of course a whole bunch of smaller nations that were allied to them. What a lot of people forget is that Hitler had a coalition too, that Germany had a coalition that was important to them that they had to maintain. The most important member of that was Romania, because Romanian oil fields and their army, a lot of people don't know this, the Romanian army, Frank, was the fourth largest army in
the world? Third largest Axis army.
Then it was the fourth largest. So a lot of people don't realize how important the Romanians were, not only from the standpoint, obviously, of their oil fields, but because their army was so large and was such a major part of both, first, the Germans and then the Russian plans. Hungary, obviously, was another ally of the Germans. Finland, we all know. Italy is an ally they may have been better without. But again, Germany has to maintain their coalition just like the Allies were trying to do. And therefore, there are these plans that were being formulated that included, what do we do to maintain our coalition? What do we do to buy time to allow these super weapons to get in and be the game changer in our benefit? And so what I want to point out to you right now are some figures just so you understand what we're talking about. In 1941, when the Germans invaded Russia, they were into the strategic reserve, way behind the front line within days. And this just disrupted the Soviet plans for defense because they could never form another defense line easily because where they wanted to form a defense line, the Germans were already past it. Okay, so in 1941, it became very difficult for the Soviets to stop the Germans until the Germans literally ran out of their logistical situation where they were at the end of their line. They were beyond rail lines. They had not been able to replace those as quickly. They were dropping gasoline and diesel fuel from airplanes to their tanks to try and keep them going. But at some point, they just literally run out of gas. And so they couldn't go any further. So what would happen is they had to regroup, and that's when the Soviets had time to reorganize, form a new defense line, and so forth. And finally, in the winter, that stopped the Germans because they had not prepared properly for that eventuality. Even though they know it's coming, it's like it's very difficult to understand that even had they won, even had they captured Moscow, you're still, what, 1,000 miles into Russia. And winter's going to happen, so you should have coats for your men. And the fact is that because logistically they did not have the capability of supplying everything to everyone. They needed ammo, they needed fuel, they needed food, they needed those things. And it's like, well, winter clothing is not part of the top three. And so there were a lot of Germans that froze to death, were killed or wounded by frostbite and so forth, and then of course, General Winter gave the Soviets the possibility to try and crush the Germans, and they threw them back tremendously from Moscow and saved Moscow. A lot of people judge that as the first turning point against the Germans in World War II. It was certainly the first major defeat of the German land army, because up to that point, the Germans had only been stopped at the Battle of Britain by the Royal Air Force, and that was considered the first defeat of Germany, but because it wasn't the ground forces, you can say, well, the German army is not yet suffered a major defeat. Moscow was that first defeat. So we get to 1942, and the Germans have suffered so many losses that they don't have the strength to attack everywhere like they did in 1941. So they had to choose where on the Russian front they're going to attack. They chose to do that in the south. The Russians also have tremendous problems because they've lost the equivalent of their entire army. They had like 3 million men. They're gone. Killed, wounded, missing, captured, and so they had to reform that. The fact that they had the capability to reform an entire army of 3 million men is just remarkable. It's incredible. And the fact that they were able to move valuable industrial factories and equipment and everything to the Urals so that they didn't lose all of that to the Germans as well. But it's going to take time for them to get that back up into production. In the meantime, Lend-Lease is saving their butts, literally. It's food is probably the most critical thing because they're losing huge areas of Russia that's food production that's behind German lines now. So the food that we're sending them is really critical. There's a lot of debate about whether the weapons we sent them are, really appreciated, whether it was that effective, whether those were as important as the other thing. But logistically, food was vital. Trucks that we sent the Soviet Union are going to be a huge game changer for them. The jeeps, we also sent a couple thousand locomotives. And this is huge because they don't have to be producing these things. They can concentrate on tanks, on aircraft, on artillery weapons. The uniforms, the boots, and the helmets are being made in Chicago and other places in the United States and being shipped to the Soviet Union. Again, their factories don't have to produce those things. Therefore, they can concentrate on the more direct weaponry and artillery shells and those things that are going to sustain them. This is unprecedented. The Soviet Union was disregarded by the Germans as being a major threat to them as far as, yeah, we're going to be able to defeat them. It's not going to be easy, but they're really not going to be a huge impediment to us. And why is that? Because everybody says, well, Napoleon made the same mistake. Don't think Napoleon. In World War I, the Germans beat Russia. You have to remember that. It was the defeat of Russia and the communists making the agreement with Germany to give them huge areas of the eastern, their eastern front that allowed all those German divisions to go west and attack the British and the French in 1918. They were hoping they could change the war before the Americans became a major influence in World War I. But the memory of the Germans is we beat them already. We defeated the Russians. They were unable to produce very much. And the Americans, why do we disregard them? Because in World War I, the Americans didn't even produce their own combat aircraft. They couldn't. It was a huge scandal. We couldn't produce our own tanks. We produced French tanks under license. So America, this industrial powerhouse that we all know, which we see today and which we know is history about World War II, that didn't exist in World War I. Adolf Hitler and Zeitler, who was his chief of staff, were comrades on the Western Front. And they remember, their experience was, we beat Russia, and America is like a paper tiger. They produce great, you know, consumer goods and automobiles and things, but they didn't even produce a good combat airplane in World War I. That's what they remember. All of that, of course, is going to change, but these are the thought patterns that are going through them when they think we can go into Russia and we should be able to defeat them before the United States becomes any kind of influence against us. This is what's going on. So in 1942, we have the big offensive in the south. We know the Germans are going to move to Stalingrad. We're going to go down to the Caucasus and attack and try and capture the oil fields down there. And the Soviets are going to scramble, because remember, they're not up to full gear yet on their factories. Their production is not up to full gear. And Lend-Lease has not yet delivered the tens and tens of thousands of trucks that it will eventually provide the Soviets with. So they're sort of in a transition. But they win this tremendous victory at Stalingrad. But in 1942, the Germans again, if they want to go somewhere, they just go wherever they want to. So although they do not have the same level of penetration in 1942 as they do in 1941, in 1942, they're able to get into almost an 800-kilometer penetration before they, again, run out of their logistical supply line. So the first 2 years of the war for them, from the German perspective, is when we want to break through and we want to go somewhere, we just do it. We have the capability, we have the experience, we have the weaponry. Yes, the Soviets have a good tank with a T-34, but we've been able to adjust to that. And guess what? We've got our own really good tanks coming out. We lost an army at Stalingrad. No one's telling Hitler he made a mistake there. But there's also a very important thing. They just lost an army in Tunisia. Panzer Army Africa was destroyed. And it was almost as many Axis soldiers eliminated there as there were at Stalingrad. This is two armies gone, and suddenly they wake up and go, oh my God, you know, we have to go in full production. Keep in mind, Germany was not at full wartime production with its civilian population like the Allies, the Western Allies, or the Soviet Union were. They're all like desperate, doing everything they can. 24-hour, you know, 8-hour shifts, three times a day, 7 days a week to make aircraft, artillery shells, train new troops and everything to stop the Germans. And the Germans are sort of doing this not in a relaxed manner, but they're not mobilizing everything they've got. And the reason is because, again, if we go back to World War I, Hitler, who served during that war, believes that the reason the Germans lost is because their people back home got fed up and gave up on the Kaiser and the chiefs of staff and all the people running the war. They'd suffered too much, they're starving, they're hungry, they're just, you don't make the people suffer because you'll lose their support. So the Nazis did everything they can to try and maintain the support of the people. And that meant you don't put too many demands on them. So you don't have to have all the women in the factories. We're going to use slave labor for that. You know, you don't draft everybody who is available of a certain age. Like even the United States was like, if you're 18 years old, boy, you're probably going to get drafted very quickly when the draft came up in late 41, 42. So Germany now realizes, after losing an army at Stalingrad, after losing an army in Tunisia, it needs to do something to at least stabilize the war. But the question is, what is it they're going to do? And I'm going to show you the comparison now between the German plans and the Soviet plans. After the Soviets destroy the German army at Stalingrad and they have a counterattack, they come all the way back and get past Kharkov. And it's at this point during the winter and spring that Manstein with his famous, what they call the backhand blow, is able to form a counterattack out of fresh units brought from the West that are refitting, particularly the SS divisions, that come in and basically capture and pocket a bunch of Soviet armor and several armies that are destroyed and stabilize the front here in the South. And this is able to prevent total disaster. Stalin thought he could get a lot more. Zhukov saying, we have the same problem the Germans do, and that we can only go so far before we run out of fuel and artillery shells and everything else. We can only keep up so far, and then we run out of gas. We literally have to stop and wait for the infantry and the logistics to catch up with us. So that was part of the reason why the front literally stopped here. So both sides are now sitting there in the beginning of the year, early spring, and they're trying to figure out, what can we do on the Eastern Front? It's basically stabilized in the almost 1,500-mile front that you see here, and there's this bulge around the town of Kursk. There's this bulge. And to put it bluntly, the Germans don't have an idea of what to do. They truly can't figure out what it is they want to do. Because if you think about, you want to maintain your coalition, you want to have people stay together on your side because they have to believe you still have a chance to win, you know what you're doing, you're going to have a capability of changing the situation to your side's favor. What do you need? Well, even if this works, you killed a lot of Russians, you destroyed a lot of tanks and everything, but you know, the town of Kursk is not any big major industrial center. That area of Russia is not particularly hugely important. It's just open steppe, most of it, rivers, hills, and so forth. There's no major mining in that area or anything like that. It's agricultural. But it was tempting because, we could cut this off and destroy all these armies. What I don't understand, even though they had planned this the prior year, is that when they had attacked Sevastopol, they had brought huge guns, mortars, and huge cannon that are mounted on railway trains, basically, that helped destroy the pillboxes and the fortifications of Sevastopol. Just shells is, you know, many times bigger than me, as tall as this room, just huge, 640 millimeter, 280 millimeter, these huge guns. And what they had done in 42, before the counterattack hit, is they were slowly moving them all the way up here because they were going to use them against Leningrad. If you wanted a symbol, just a victory to be a symbol that you still are dictating what's going on the Eastern Front, that you can still pull off a victory, this is a prize, Leningrad. What better city to grab than Lenin's city? Moscow is too far away, Stalingrad is out of the question, but Leningrad not only is possible to win, you notice the Soviets during the summer cannot reinforce it. I mean, they're cut off still, and the ice bridge that they have in the winter, that's a limited logistical supply for them, is not there because the lake now is not frozen. There's another benefit. Once you destroy these armies and take Leningrad, you now have an unbroken line to go into Finland, which means you can transfer troops up to Murmansk and try and knock that out. At least the Soviets have to allow for that possibility. That stretches the front, and all of a sudden, these few units out here have to be reinforced. And that means pulling units from the center up to there, and if they're there, they're not being used to counterattack the Germans. So, offensively, the Germans could do that without having to tie up their armor because they don't need their panzer divisions to do that. They can do it with infantry, and another benefit is they could have all their coalition buddies go into Leningrad at the same time, and everyone gets to put their flag up, German flag, Hungarian flag, Romanian flag, Finnish flag, yay, we're winning the war. And what do you do with all those panzer divisions you formed? Well, Guderian, he thinks, we're just going to sit back and let the Russians beat their heads against us. That's what he wants to do. He was brought back in February of 43 after this disaster. This army and all these other allied armies are crushed and they're pushed back into the south. He's brought back. Hitler had fired him in 1941 because he retreated. He disobeyed orders and he retreated with his panzer group. And therefore, it's like he's fired. A whole bunch of other generals were fired. And he's just been sitting out the war, all 42. But now Hitler brings him back and says, I need your help. Reorganize the Panzer troops. It's a mess. You know, it's just total mess. We have these new tanks coming out. I want you to take charge of this. Get it organized. So Guderian's idea is, he looks at this and says, let's let them beat their heads on us. You know, we've got these long-range weapons. They can't even get close to us. Our 88-millimeter guns are good. The Tiger's proven itself. We have this new Panther tank coming out with a very long 75 that is actually has a longer range than the 88 on the Tiger. That means that you can sit there, and at least a mile or more away, you can pick off Russian tanks that cannot even shoot back at you. This is a huge advantage, and it is going to be a huge factor also in the Battle of Kursk. But that's Guderian's idea, okay? Manstein believes that they should attack because if they just sit there, they don't know if they're going to put their tanks in the right area or their troops in the right area. If you allow the other side to have the initiative, his argument is, then we don't know what could happen, and we may not have our forces where they need to be when we're hit, and we could end up scrambling and lose all this territory anyway, and we've just given the initiative to the Soviets. Hitler listens to both of them, and he figures, again, politically he has to do something, because he's got to keep his coalition together. So they decide that they're going to do this operation at Kursk. And it actually breaks down into, they're debating several different possible ways of going into Kursk. The first is just a small little encirclement called Habik. Then Panther is, well, let's do a little bit bigger. And then they decide, oh, wait, let's just go for the whole, you know, whole nine yards here. And we're going to go for Citadel, which is Citadel. Same word in English. And we're going to go and link up at Kursk. We're going to have the 9th Army and 4th Panzer Army link up here. And Army Group South is here. Army Group Center is here. And basically, these two forces are going to meet up, and we're going to destroy the Soviets. There's a very interesting thing about this that is going on that is nothing to do with the ground forces, and it doesn't have anything to do with the intelligence forces on either side. The most important thing that aircraft did in World War I and World War II was reconnaissance, because that reconnaissance was vital to telling you whether your artillery is hitting properly, where his forces are deployed. There's a lot of attempts to camouflage, but you can't camouflage trench lines. You can partially, but basically there are a lot of defensive positions and a lot of other things that you can do to divine what's going on with your aircraft, because they have wonderful photographic capabilities. And what has changed now is that you and I know by looking at this map that the Soviets have a huge number of troops way back, miles, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles back. There are all these armies, all these mechanized corps back here. The Germans don't know that. And the reason they don't know that is because by this time of 1943, the Soviet Red Air Force has been rebuilt, and they now have over 8,000 fighter planes. That's more than the entire Luftwaffe has of every fighter or every plane that they've got, not just fighters, but everything. So they were able to make it so costly to the German air reconnaissance units that they were unable to penetrate too far. They got a lot of information here also from ground units, from radio intercepts and so forth, but these that are maintaining radio silence and also are being denied the Luftwaffe to look and reconnaissance these areas, the Germans have no idea. Therefore, when the Germans made an estimation of how many Soviets they were up against in 1943, had they done this and killed, captured, or wounded everybody in that pocket, which is over 1 million men, it would have only lowered the number of actual Soviet soldiers to what the Germans had estimated. That means they were off by over 1 million men, and all these formations back here are not even, they're not even aware of them. That's how far the things have shifted on the Eastern Front, where the Soviets have taken the initiative on air reconnaissance, on denying areas that they want to. It's not the entire front. This is way too huge, and even for 8,000 aircraft. But you can pick and choose areas where you want to deny the enemy from seeing too much. Can't prevent it 100%, but you can sure cut it down tremendously. So as a result, the Germans, by doing this, even had it succeeded, would not have changed the entire Eastern Front like they thought it was going to do. So that was a huge mistake. There's another thing that's very fascinating about this battle is that I told you that when the Germans thought that they could attack, they would be able to break through wherever they wanted to and do pretty much what they wanted. It's just a question of how many losses they would suffer. Okay? The Germans believed that. So did the Soviets. The Soviets believed the same thing the Germans did. They believed that whenever the Germans attack, they're going to break through. Even though they have all this warning, they know the Germans through their basically their intelligence, or the buried spies that are in part of the German general staff, they're feeding them information, the Red Orchestra, which is their spy group in Berlin. They're learning that this is going to be the operation. This is where the Germans are, and therefore they're able to dig and prepare trench lines, anti-tank ditches, put in hundreds of anti-tank guns, thousands of tanks and new self-propelled guns, and millions of mines. And still they believe the Germans are going to break through. They don't have confidence that they're going to be able to stop the Germans cold. They believe that what's going to happen is the Germans are going to break through, and hopefully we will cause so much damage and so many losses that when they do break through, all of these units that we have that are fresh are going to be able to be launched in a counterattack and then basically stop the Germans and inflict strategic losses on them that they can't replace as easily as we can. This is just a numbers game. Okay? So the Soviets and the Germans both believed the same thing before this battle. All right? And they're both going to be wrong. But the difference is, because the Germans are wrong in a big way, it's more fatal to them than it is the Soviets, because the Soviets are going to be able to replace everything I'm going to show you that they're going to lose, and the Germans, even though it's a tiny amount, those skilled crewmen and officers and all the other things they're going to lose, they cannot replace as easily as the Soviets. And there's one other thing about the Eastern Front that I want to say, because a lot of people know that, the Soviets did most of the fighting in World War II. The Soviets tied up most of these German divisions. You know, they did most of the damage. They're the ones who should get a lot more credit than the Western Allies. Okay. I agree with the fact that they tied up more German divisions. They absolutely did that. But there's a couple of things that made it much easier for the Soviets to concentrate. This is it. This is the only front they have to worry about. It's huge, but they don't have to worry about the Pacific. They don't have to worry about Africa. They don't have to worry about Southern Europe. They don't have to worry about Northern Europe. They don't have to worry about the sea lanes. I mean, all those supplies are still coming through to them, that we're fighting a U-boat war as well. The Allies in the West, you know, you can sit there and say, okay, yes, the German divisions against us are less than what the Soviets are up against, but we're fighting all the U-boats. We're fighting everything in the Mediterranean. And by the way, we've got to fight Japan too. Okay, so this is not, the Soviets don't even have to worry about those things. So when we talk about who did most of the fighting, who gets most of the credit, I absolutely believe the Soviets have been not given as much credit as they deserve. They certainly haven't been given the kind of credit for the losses they took, civilian as well as military, or the fact that they're learning how to fight and they finally defeated the Germans, not because they just used huge numbers, but because they're learning, and I'm going to show you that, important things that made them a much better army than it was in 1941. And that's going to start showing up here at Kursk. But I also want to say that, you know, the Western Allies deserve a tremendous amount of credit, because had we not been bombing Germany and causing all those anti-aircraft guns to be built and manned by, even though there are a lot of them by teenagers, or all the fighter aircraft that had to be pulled back to the homeland to defend them, all of those could have been made into tanks, all that steel. So instead of maybe the 30 divisions of panzers and panzer grenadiers that the Soviets are fighting, there could have been 60. So the contribution of the Western Allies should not be denigrated because the Soviets say, hey, we tied up the infantry divisions, we tied up their panzer divisions, because that's only part of the story. I think there's enough credit to go around. The Soviets deserve their credit for it, but I believe the Western Allies absolutely continue to deserve a decent share of the victory. It was a true joint effort, at least between the United States and the Soviet Union, who put in the most. You know, Great Britain, just because it held out and it was an important partner. And without Great Britain, there would not have been a possibility of us getting in the war, and it's very likely the Soviets would have been knocked out. So the Cold War would have been between, and this is a good thing for Monday we can talk about with the alternate histories, the Cold War would have been between Nazi Germany and the United States instead of the Soviet Union. So this is the background story, and I wanted to tell you that because the Soviets could concentrate just on this, they put all their effort in. And yet, the Germans are going to break through an area, and one of the reasons they're going to break through in the south, more effectively than in the north, is because in the area in the north here, it's divided in the central front and the Voronezh front. These are the fronts, and there's like a line going through here. So Voronezh is down here and central front's here. In the Voronezh front, you have a commander who's in charge of the front. And a front is like an army group for the Germans, okay? And he is, Voronezh, I'll just, it's about Teuthen is the Voronezh front, and Rokossovsky is the one in the north. This is where personality makes a huge difference. And you always wonder, why do certain divisions or certain corps or certain armies, why do they perform better? Why does the Africa Corps do so well and then, say, some army at Stalingrad do so poorly? It's all about the personalities of the men who are leading it. This is not only the guy on top, but what he expects from his officers, how much leeway he gives them, and who he selects to be the guys around him. Are they yes men, or are they going to say, no, we shouldn't do it that way, I'll show you another way to do it, and does he let him do that? Rommel was very effective in Africa. He was also less influenced by the general and general staff, which wasn't always looking over his shoulder. But I think in the case of Stalingrad, Paulus was just going to do whatever he's told. So rather than show any initiative, he's just going to do what he was told, and therefore he stayed, and his army got annihilated. Well, same thing is true on the Soviet side. So Vatutin is not in control of his officers as well as Rokossovsky, and this is how you can see that. There is a commissar with the army, obviously, and there's also a guy who's in charge of the infantry, and there's a guy in charge of the anti-tank troops. They're not integrated the way that we would think they would be. So there's a guy who's in charge of all the anti-tank defenses, and he's supposed to work with the infantry guy. Supposed to. And Vatutin's sector and his Voronezh front, these two guys hate each other. We have no idea why they're not getting along, why the commissar is not saying, you've got to work this out or you're both going to be shot, okay? But they didn't. And so what happened is the anti-tank guy goes out and he decides, I'm going to put out my own plan, screw the guy with the infantry. You know? You show up, fine, right? And this guy's going, well, we'll see, right? It's like, no one, certainly Stalin does not know this is happening, and neither does Zhukov, who is his main chief of staff. And Rokossovsky in the north is like, no. We're all getting organized. We're coordinating this. So he has his artillery guy, his anti-tank guy, his infantry guy. They're all getting together, and they're having meetings, and he's saying, this is all the plan. We're all on the same page. We know what's going on. As a result, the Germans are going to only penetrate 10 miles in the north, but they're going to penetrate almost 30 miles in the south. Just a huge difference there. And one of the factors, not the only factor, but one of the factors is these guys aren't talking to each other. It's hard to imagine us today looking back thinking that these guys are being that petty in World War II when there's such huge stakes. I mean, everything is on the line. Your country, the survival of your nation is at stake, and all you can do is argue with the guy who you're supposed to be working with so that, I'm not going to listen to you. Right? It's like, what? But this is what's going on. This is the kind of thing that is going on and why the Russians are not going to do as well as you would think they would do with millions of mines, miles of anti-tank ditches and trenches, and hundreds of anti-tank guns. That's one of the reasons why. It's just simply because the guys aren't going to work. They don't play together well. Okay? So these are the things that are background. And then the other myth about this battle is had it either started earlier or had the Germans continued it, they would have broken through. Eventually, they were almost there, but they were stopped because the Western Allies invaded Sicily. And they did that in July, and Hitler switched the SS Corps that was there because he didn't want to have Italy get knocked out of the war. He rushed them back from the Eastern Front and down into Italy along with other units, and that stopped the offensive in the south. And Manstein had argued, no, throw in our last reserve, the Russians are almost done. Well, the myth here is that the German reserves at that point consisted of 181 unused tanks. That's it. That's all they had. Those armored vehicles were their reserve to be thrown in. The Soviets had not yet thrown in over 2,000 vehicles that the Germans didn't know about. So even had these 181 vehicles been thrown forward and maybe made a few more miles, there was no way that they're going to eventually overrun the 2,000 and some tanks. That's the reality. But again, Manstein's argument at the time, because he didn't know, has been picked up by other authors who, again, if you're only reading the German side of this, it's like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. I'm sure he could have pulled it off. It's like, no, 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 just look at the numbers. I mean, in some cases, as Stalin used to say, which is very valid, is that quantity has its own quality. So having more tanks than the other side by a factor of 10 or 20 is going to make a difference. Okay, even if you lose half of them, you're still going to win as long as they're getting eliminated at the same rate. So the other thing is, what if we now, okay, what if we did this earlier? Okay, forget the later part. We know that that's not going to work. What if we started this in May? Okay, what if we did that? We know that the Russians would not have time to put up all those mines, dig all those miles of trenches and anti-tank ditches, and all those units that came in, or all the units they got equipped with new T-34s and the new SUs, the self-propelled guns with the 152s and the 122s. All of those weapons would not have been there, and all those other defensive positions would not have been built. So could they have done it in May? And Hitler is usually blamed. This is great. You can always blame a dead guy because he cannot contradict you. So every German general, if they ever wanted to say, had they done it my way, we would have won, this would have happened, but Hitler wouldn't listen to me. Of course, Hitler's not around to say it's bullshit. You know, he's not around to say that. So Hitler is blamed for the delay because he wanted to wait until more Tigers and more Panzers, the brand new Panther tank, 300 of those puppies were ready to go put into the battle because they were going to change the battle, okay? I have no contradictory evidence to say that Hitler did not delay it for that reason, but it was one of the reasons that he thought that would make a difference. The fact that 300 tanks could make a difference when your entire army in that area is 1,500 tanks is questionable. And when you already know you are outnumbered, the Germans did not think that they outnumbered the Soviets ever. They always knew the Soviets had more men, more vehicles, more of everything. But they thought, we can deal with it because their training isn't as good, their equipment isn't as good. And people are going to say, wait, the T-34 is great. The T-34 is a wonderful weapon, but it doesn't have a radio. Most of them did not have a radio, and the ones that did were mostly receivers, so they could be told what to do. But if you're sitting there at the end of a column and you see a Tiger tank, you have no way of telling the rest of your buddies, there's a Tiger tank on your tail. That meant that in a Soviet unit, a tank unit, you would have huge losses without being able to do anything about it, because all you could do is just watch it happen. You're supposed to be able to signal with flags or something else, but, you know, it's not happening. So losses were very high on the Soviet side. They were just hoping to keep nibbling the Germans down and causing enough losses for them that they would eventually be overwhelmed by the Soviets. And that is what happened on the Eastern Front. So let's take a look at... Oh, I haven't finished. I'm sorry. So May 4th, if we could have kicked this off on May 4th, we wouldn't have the Panther tanks and we wouldn't have those as many Tiger tanks. So would it have mattered? When you look at the way the Germans are going to fight this, they have basically light tanks. They have a few Mark IIs. Those are the ones they used in Poland, okay? They're very light tanks. Could not stand up to anything the Soviets had to shoot at with them. They have Mark III tanks, which are good in North Africa, but they're way outmoded by this point. So the German basic tank is the Mark IV, which most of us have seen. And the Tiger is the heavy tank that the Germans had with the 88. And what they had planned to do is they were going to engage the Germans by moving the Mark IVs forward to let the T-34s and the Soviet defenses expose themselves by shooting at these tanks. Hopefully they'd survive, or they'd get them to shoot far enough in advance, not everybody would get knocked out, especially since the strongest armor is on the front. They thought they could survive the 76mm gun being used by the Soviets for most of their units. At that point, once it's opened up, the guys in the Tigers who were way back here, where the Soviets can't even see them, start picking them off, which is what would happen. The Mark IIIs are out on the flanks, just sort of keeping down any infantry that's trying to infiltrate. And the Soviets gave orders, do not engage these guys out on the sides because they're just light tanks. They can't do anything to us. Don't worry about it. They're not going to be the breakthrough. But the Tigers suffered very few permanent losses. And I'll tell you how each army basically decided how to count a tank loss. This is very important because something's going to happen at this battle that had never happened before with the Soviets. But in order to understand that, you have to understand how the armies were counting their losses in the field. What does that mean? You'll see in records, you'll see in the reports, a tank is written off, a tank is lost, a tank is permanently lost. Well, what's lost and what's permanently lost? Well, leaving it to the Germans love to have lots of different levels of things. And so here's how they did that. They had classifications where you could have a unit that says a tank is repairable within a few days. So it stays in the unit. So if it's part of this Panzer battalion, it stays there. It's going to be repaired. Maybe it just needs, it broke some treads, it broke some road wheels on a mine, for example, or it had minor damage done and it just needs waiting for those parts or whatever to get back into working condition. Also, one important thing. I told you that the Soviets don't have radios on most of their tanks, or at least not transmitters. They have a lot of receivers now, but not as many transmitters. The Germans have lots of radios, not only tank to tank, but within the tank itself. Each of the guys has earphones so that the tank commander doesn't have to scream or yell to get attention. He can talk to each of his guys and get them to work as a team, which makes a German tank incredibly efficient. It can get off many more rounds. A Tiger tank can get off many more rounds much more quickly than a T-34. T-34 has two guys in the turret at this point. Eventually they will build the T-34-85 that's three guys. But what does this mean? Well, if one guy is the gunner shooting and he has to concentrate there, that means the tank commander is the guy that has to hop down and load the gun. And if he's doing that, he's not looking around and he's certainly not commanding the tank. So that cuts down their efficiency tremendously. Another little innovation the Germans had was a throat mic. I don't know if you've ever been anywhere where you've seen, like, you've seen the mics that people talk into. The German Americans had a lot of those type of mics in their tanks. But that means that any background noise, any noise at all, is coming through that mic as well, and it makes it tough for guys to hear. It's a really strange thing, but the throat mic, you can actually hear the guy much more clearly. And so that was one of the important things the Germans started from the beginning of the war, is to have every unit, all the tanks, except for the Mark 1s, the Mark 2s, 3s, 4s, and all the tanks after that, and the Stugs, the self-propelled guns, had radios, 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 and they were commanded by guys whose tank was only filled with radios and antenna because he was directing everybody. This direction was critical because it allowed the Germans to react quicker and also to adjust to threats or to take advantage of exploitation in situations. The Germans also had somebody else in units. Say your unit was supposed to be the spearhead of a breakthrough. You would have a Luftwaffe guy assigned to you. And what was his job? He has a radio, too. And he's right there with the guy who's the commander of that Panzer unit. So they would say, you see that village up ahead? We need air support against that. And this Luftwaffe guy then would signal his Stukas, or FW-190 ground attack guys, and they would go in and hit that. And he would say, no, you missed it. Come back and, you know, do that. There's no such guy on the Soviet side doing this. That means that if there's an air attack, the air guy is being given orders. He goes over, does his attack, goes away, and it seems random to anybody. If they hit the right target, great. If they don't, well, he's done his job and he goes away. There was no way to recall them, no way to keep them on the target or to direct them somewhere. So again, the Germans are extremely efficient with this. They've been doing this for some time also. This is not a new thing for them. So this is a really good army in 1943, which is also contributing to their arrogance that we've always done this and we've always beaten the Russians and we're going to do it again. And in fact, the losses, this is the strange thing. I was talking to a friend of mine who was a veteran, American veteran, who was in a small unit, and I said, why could they not understand that they had lost this battle? And he says, at a low level, at this level where you're a tanker, because they only suffered 12% casualties of permanent losses, if you're a tanker and you have been inflicting 7-8-1 casualties, and that's just the tanks you've been knocking out, and you've been able to go forward, maybe not as fast as you want to, but you're basically doing what you want, and then you're just simply pulling back and go somewhere else. At your level, you haven't lost. It doesn't feel like a loss. It doesn't feel like you've been stopped or anything of that nature. But strategically, the guys in the headquarters should be able to tell what a disaster this is, because they spent their ammunition, their men, their armor, the things they couldn't replace easily, their aircraft, for a very limited objective that's not going to work. And this is a huge strategic blunder, but it's not going to be recognized at a low level. As far as those guys are concerned, we did great again. You know, let's just move on and kick their butt somewhere else. Okay, so we got losses. A tank is repairable in a couple of days, whatever that means. If it takes longer, like 2 weeks, let's say it's a lot of damage, maybe two mines hit it, or maybe a round penetrated, killed some guys, but they can basically clean out the tank, repair the damage that was done, so the tank didn't burn, it didn't like get totally destroyed, but it's going to take about 2 weeks. That also would be a tank that would stay in the unit, in other words, with that same Panzer battalion. It's not a permanent loss. But then you have a permanent loss. And what that means in the German army is it had to be removed from the unit, either because it couldn't be recovered, it's destroyed, or just not worth recovering, or it goes back to the factory. That's the only place we could fix it, for whatever reason. It's like the Soviets have this 152-millimeter howitzer, huge gun, on a self-propelled T-34 chassis. And when it hit this round, if it hit a Tiger or a Panther, it did huge damage, but it wouldn't penetrate. It wasn't designed for that. But it was so huge that it would crack armor. It would crack the welds. It would literally crack the armor on the tank. And the only place you can repair that is send it back to Germany and have it repaired at the factory. So that's a loss, permanent loss, okay? Because my unit no longer has it, okay? The same thing is true with, like I said, anything that's burned out on the field or that they capture. That's a permanent loss as well. So the Germans are only counting those things that are truly permanently lost to them. But every day, you're always repairing these tanks, and the Germans, from the very beginning of the war, kept repairing these tanks and getting them back into operation. That's why, even if they say we have 1,500 tanks, they're able to keep maybe 1,000 in operation just because of their repair crews and their highly trained groups of men that are out there every night, hauling these tanks back, you know, dragging them back with tank recovery vehicles or other tanks to pull them back someplace where they can repair them, get them back into working condition, and these are the guys that are keeping the battle going. Soviets didn't have that. In a war game term, the Soviets had no depth on their armor units. So if you had a tank corps or even a tank army in 41 or 42, and you move it forward on the game board and engage the enemy, that unit, your Soviet unit, is destroyed whether it wins or loses. And why is that? That's because they have no tank recovery or repair at all. There's no such thing on the Soviet side. So simply because tanks get worn out, they run out of gas, or they get damaged, or they throw a tread, or they get knocked out, but it's not totally burned out, they have no way to recover that tank. They have no way to bring it back. So it just sits on the battlefield. Even if the Soviets have the battlefield, they can't do anything with it. So after a couple of weeks, every Soviet corps or tank brigade or army is literally run out of armor. And they didn't have, in 41 and 42, all the extra elements of any aircraft, any tank, mortars, artillery, all the things that would give them some more punch. It was just tanks. So if you run out of your tanks, that unit's gone. So, like I said, in terms of if you're playing a game, if you were to commit that unit, whether it wins or loses, you take it off the board. It's gone. It's just a question of how much damage it's going to do to the Germans. Well, in 43, that's all going to change. Yes, Frank?
A brief anecdote.
Yes.
Not so much anecdote, but we have very good numbers on the Soviet armored units that were in the exploitation after Stalingrad, leading up to von Manstein's backhand blow.
Right.
And it's the daily tank strengths are just a line like that.
Straight down.
And it's whether or not, and it's pretty much independent of whether or not they are in action with the enemy. You know, if they're in action with the enemy, they're losing them to losses. If they're not in action, they're going like crazy and they're losing them from breakthroughs, but breakdowns.
Right.
They're losing the same amount.
Yes. Whether they fight,
they're just losing tanks.
If you're lucky enough not to run run into the Germans, you're still losing all your tanks. They're all going to go away.
And
which means,
it's going to be exhausted. Yeah.
Right. So in war game terms, if I put that unit forward and it runs into Germans, it's eliminated. In war game terms, if there's no German in front of me, if I go two hexes, it's eliminated. Okay, so that's basically it. So the Soviets have real problems, but in 43, something critical happens. The Americans have supplied tank recovery vehicles to the Soviets, and they're training people to do exactly that, to recover vehicles. They're also using some of their own T-34s with winches and cranes and things, or just towing other vehicles, and they have guys whose only job it is to basically grab these vehicles and repair them to get them back into operation. Why is this important? Well, as we just pointed out, if you've got a tank army of 2,000 tanks, within a couple of weeks, it's gone. It's just simply gone, and you don't have it to use again. In this battle, the Soviets are going to repair 40% of their losses and get them back in to combat. This is huge, because the Germans are going to be killing these tanks at 7 or 10 to 1, but 40% of those are coming back. Pretty nasty, because the guys inside are usually getting killed and thrown all around. And the Germans are going to do something as a result of this battle also, they're going to learn, because they're going to see this. They're going to be tanks with holes in them that they're going to have knocked out again. They're going to look at this and they'll realize, we can't stop shooting until we see it burn. So the Americans are going to take the brunt of this, which we don't understand why this is happening, but they're going to, I've seen one picture of the Battle of the Bulge where there's 788 rounds in a Sherman. Just, you know, nice little pattern. Somebody like it was shooting on a shooting gallery. And they're doing that because until they see the tank burn. And why is that? Because when a tank burns, it does two things. One, it burns out all the electrical stuff inside, but it also ruins the steel, the integrity of the temper of the steel is gone. And it's a dead tank. Now it's a total write-off. So the Germans are going to learn you've got to do that as a result of this battle, because the Soviets are going to be so good about putting the tanks back into action. That's another thing they had never done before. They have now sustaining power to keep their armor in action. And that's huge. There's also this little side note that people don't realize. We don't have detailed reports, but we have enough reports to suggest that this was going on. Every night, the Germans sort of formed a little, you know, tank locker of their tanks to protect themselves and the guys that tried to go to sleep inside. Well, Stalin did something really interesting before the battle. He thought, you know, I got to have every motivation I've got to get my guys to fight. So he issues this order that says, if you destroy a German tank, forget the Order of Lenin, forget the medals, you get, like, it was 100,000 rubles or something. It was like an astronomical figure, especially for people back then. Think of probably a soldier is getting a few hundred rubles a month. It was like, holy cow. This is a pure capitalist incentive that Stalin's giving them. Kill a tank, make a lot of rubles, okay? It's like, what? So there were probably not many of these, although a clever commissar who reports this could have reported something with the guy and split the rubles, okay? But I suspect that most of them who were going out every night to do this, the only thing they were doing is annoying the crap out of the Germans who were trying to get some sleep. And all of a sudden, ping, ping, these anti-tank rifles are shooting at these German tanks that are sitting in a lager while these guys are just trying to get rest, and they're never given a chance to get a good night's sleep because the Russians are out there trying to get their 100,000 rubles. Okay, so this is going on. There's also something else every night happening. What else is on the battlefield? Remember that even though we see this looks hugely compacted, but when you get down to that level where battalions have moved through an area, you may have overrun and left some guys behind you, your infantry's back there, it's dark, we're going to form a logger, we've got tanks behind us that have been knocked out, someone's got to get it, we tell our battalion, come forward. Well, there's also a bunch of Soviet stuff. So during the night, both sides are running their guys out onto the battlefield, their tank repair guys and recovery guys. And so they're trying to grab tanks, not only their tanks, they're trying to grab the other guy's tanks so that they can't repair those, and they're trying to sneak off the battlefield. So these little gunfights are going on, you know, over these tanks. It's like a microcosm within the battle, and they're fighting to grab tanks and take them back and repair them, both sides now, which had never happened before. A curious thing to me is that In North Africa, if one side had the battlefield, that's what they were able to do, is recover all the tanks. But I don't recall, Frank, you'd studied that. Did the British and Germans ever have a battle between the repair and recovery crews in North Africa like there was here?
Not that I'm aware of.
I didn't think so. Because one side or the other always had control of the battlefield after that, right?
Yeah, and nobody tended to do it at night. They tended to recover during the day.
Oh, in North Africa? Okay. These guys were not going to do it during the day, trust me. Like, you try to walk out there on the battlefield to grab a tank, it's like, you're done. You know, infantry is not living long in this thing. One of the amazing things that happened in this battle, the Germans are going to lose about 20,000 dead in this battle, both north and south. And they have maybe 60,000 wounded and out of action for various lengths of time. So it's about 80,000 guys gone on the German side for this battle. Now remember, the Russians are prepared. They're prepared as best as they could possibly be, months in advance. They're going to lose almost 500,000 guys. And when I first saw this, I said, no, can't be. It's like, yep. It's stunning. And the reason is because once they were put in a position to hold, that's it. They don't have the option to, you know what, this is not a good position, let's get out of here. The infantry, that when they're put in there, or an anti-tank group is put in there, they're basically going to sit there until they're eliminated or relieved. And that's what happened in many cases. The Germans would be able to isolate these groups and basically destroy them, and systematically. Plus, they were able to do it because they had standoff weapons. If I can punch you from here and you can't reach me, you're going to get beaten up a lot. And that's what happened. It's the same thing, is that my tanks, my aircraft, my radio coordination of these elements, and even though I don't have as much artillery, I'll put four guns on you right now that I need and then move around you, whereas the Soviets don't have that capability yet. Oh, what? We have 5 minutes? We have 5 minutes total for an hour? Or
yeah.
Okay, well then we have Q&A after that. Okay, so let me jump ahead and show you, I want to show you what they lost. This is the important thing. Okay. By the way, just real quick, this is the big tank battle everyone talks about is Prokhorovka, which is right here. This is Prokhorovka, and the SS Corps is supposed to go in there. But what's interesting is you have the Leibstandarte, which is 1st SS, is the unit that's going here. But Totenkopf, actually, 3rd SS, gets the furthest penetration in this area, even though they're not going to Prokhorovka. And the Das Reich is down here. So really, the reason I was saying it's not the biggest battle armor-wise is that it's only one division, Leibstandarte, that's running up against the 5th Guards Tank Army. So they're the main units that are fighting here. It is a couple thousand tanks, but that's very similar to El Alamein. That's very similar to Cobra, the breakout in Normandy. So this particular battle, you really can't say is the biggest tank battle of World War II. But if you include everything, the Orel Bulge, the northern flank of Kursk, then yes, absolutely, you have the most tanks ever engaged in one area of World War II. Let me find my losses. I'll show you real quick what that kill ratio was and what that meant when everybody was done. Oh, here we go. Okay. This is on the northern flank, and this is Voronezh, which is on the south, okay? And the south is more important, as I was saying. This is where most of the fighting happened. So the starting totals of the tanks are here. It's 2,694. Their losses were 1,773 out of that group, but they repaired 769, okay? I know this looks weird. This is the Su-152. They lose two, but they get 11. That's because replacements are coming in. So this includes not only repaired, but it includes new tanks coming in, okay? So they did get reinforcements during the battle. But a couple of interesting things here. These are all self-propelled guns. The Germans had impressed the Soviets with the Stukes, but also because of the Tiger, the Soviets realized they needed something with a big gun on it to have any chance to fight the Tiger. So they literally put a big 122 and a big 152 on a T-34 chassis in just a big steel box. And so they brought those in. They're not a lot, but they're just coming in force. The interesting thing, this is the last battle of the light tank. Light tanks are gone after this. There are not only T-70s and T-60s on the Soviet side, but look at the losses. I mean, this is just, it's devastating. because they can't stand up to anything. I mean, there's such light armor that they're going to get destroyed by just about anything that the Germans have. Also, the Stuart, the M3, this is a Lend-Lease. Again, that's also a light tank. They're not going to use it anymore. The M3M, that's the Grant. You probably have seen that in North Africa with the 75 and then the turret with the 37, the American tank that preceded the Sherman. And then you've got the Matilda, the Valentine, and the Churchill. And the Matilda, as you can see, 14 out of 18. These aren't big numbers, but you wonder, it's like, if the Soviets didn't like these Lend-Lease tanks, why are they using them? They're using everything. And this, I don't know whether this is really indicative, but it's curious to me. All of the Lend-Lease were in Guards units, and that's an honorific, and you don't get that easily. Frank, do you have any?
That's probably coincidental at Kursk, because there are a lot of Lend-Lease units that are not in Guard units. I've run across a bunch that are not in Guard units.
Okay.
But now what happens later on in 44 is really interesting, because there are a whole bunch of the premier Guard tank and mechanized units re-equipped with Shermans.
That's because the Shermans are more reliable.
Shermans are 2-30-45s instead of the Sherman 76s.
Right.
Because they prefer them for the deep operation.
Yes. Anyway, so you can see that the majority of tanks, of course, are T-34s. These are the two-man turret 76mm T-34s. The T-34-85, the upgun version, is going to happen next year in 44, and it will have three men in the turret to try and allow the commander to do commander things instead of doubling as a loader. And the KV, again, there aren't very many. It's even less numbers than some of the Lend-Lease things. But you can see that they're trying their best to repair or replace the losses, and this is the big difference, is that in a prior year, this wouldn't exist. This would be permanently gone. And so that difference in this battle is going to make all the difference, because that'll help the Soviets sustain their offensives all through 44 and 45, because their guys are just going to get better at that, and they're going to be able to do more. Let me show you the German losses. Here we go. Now, I just showed you that between the two Soviet ones, there's about 1,300 permanently destroyed tanks, okay? And these are permanent right here. These are like gone forever. 287. So it's about 12% of all the German tanks that were there. About a third of the Soviet tanks are gone forever. Keeping in mind that a lot of those Soviet tanks were destroyed 2 and 3 times. Okay? So we're not even including that. We're just counting this tank as a tank, even if it's been knocked out 2 or 3 times. So the Germans are doing a kill ratio. 287 versus that 1,300 is about 5-6 to 1. But if you include the tanks that are being destroyed 2 or 3 times, that's jumping to 7, 8, 9 to 1. That's the kill ratio the Germans are inflicting on the Soviets. So again, from their perspective, we're not losing this battle. We're inflicting much heavier casualties on them, right?
But Dana, aren't the Germans repairing tanks too?
Yes. But these are the permanent. Right, they're also
prepared. So they're only counting permanent losses.
This is permanent losses only.
So. It seems to me that the number that they're claiming doesn't escalate. That includes some tanks. The number of Soviet tanks knocked out, sometimes it's the same tank knocked out 2 or 3 times.
No.
And brought back.
But I see what you're saying. In other words, that number is that. I see what you're saying is that this number on the Soviet side includes
all this number of tanks knocked out, and then you've got. Okay, yes.
So this could be including 2 or 3 times less, because if they're repairing 2 or 3 tanks for every one of those, right, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's the total number against the total number of Germans. So it right. still
if
comes up.
If a tank is knocked out, repaired, knocked out, repaired, it's knocked out 3 times.
Right.
So that's 3.
That's 3 on there. Right.
Yeah.
It's 3 losses on here. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, yes, it's still 5-6 to 1 kill ratio, which shows. Pretty awful, really, especially when you don't add in the anti-tank units and the infantry and everybody else who are getting nailed. So, again, if you look at the statistics, even though the Soviets have stopped the Germans, heavy losses, even when the Soviets win. In fact, one of the things that I was just reminded of by a professor who's very disappointed that his Russian friends, young friends in Russia, he's a professor my age, are forgetting World War II. And he said, you know, we took Berlin in World War II, but it cost us 1 million casualties, 1 million men killed, wounded, or missing. That's for a victory. The Soviets, you know, they may have used blunt force to destroy the Germans, but it's like if you took a sledgehammer and crushed a walnut, you're crushing the walnut, but what's happening is you're breaking the sledgehammer every time. You know, it's just amazing losses that the Soviets are taking. Anyway, these are some of the most important differences around this, but the myths and misconceptions and some of the things that people don't know about, the secrets about Kursk, that I wanted to bring forward to tell you what is really, to me, the real story behind what happened at Kursk, why it's so important, why it happened, and why it made a difference in the war on the Eastern Front. It wasn't just simply an important big battle. It was a turning point, especially in Soviet capability and in German inability to do things from that point on, including air reconnaissance and ever take the initiative again on the Eastern Front. Thank you very much. I've opened it up to questions now. Yes, sir.
Last night I went online to get some background information about the Battle of Kursk, and I came across an article, and I wish I brought it along, and it talked about the myths, as you mentioned. And one of the things that it mentioned was that during the battle, there was an SS, several SS divisions that, what was the name of that town, Para?
Prokhorovka.
Prokhorovka, that had made breakthroughs. They actually made breakthroughs, and they were on their way. And if I understand this correctly, the German high command held them back. And the argument in this article was that maybe if the Germans had gone forward, they might have turned the battle.
That was part of the argument Manstein was making, that if we just threw in our last reserve, we're almost there. We're penetrating through, finally, to the strategic reserve. We're getting through. The reality is that wasn't happening. The Soviets had so many more units they could have brought forward, 2,000 tanks alone, that they could have plugged any holes that happened. We look at these battlefields and these maps, and we assume that that line means it's a solid line of troops, and that's not the case. It might be that line represents a forward position of several platoons or a tank company or something, but there could be, you know, a half a mile between me and my next comrade. So there could be a gap between us. So penetrations happen all the time. In fact, if you look at, where do I have that? I can show, that map I wanted to show you, that this is the one right here. Take a look at this. Here is exactly that portion. Do you see the 3rd SS up here has broken through? And then you see these arrows, counter arrows? You see how they've broken through and are turning back? The line is not a solid line. This is not like it's a line of trenches that are being held by, you know, troops lined up one after another. This is an approximate position of like a battalion or a company, which means there's a gap in there and someone's able to get through with this Guards Rifle Regiment, but then because they've been hammered by artillery or a counterattack, they then turn back. And this is probably a penetration by with some tanks. They're turned back at this hill. And then the Germans have this penetration up here. And the reason they're forced back is when they did this, the SS units did not have, at least in 3rd SS, did not have armored infantry vehicles, meaning that they only had trucks. Well, those are very vulnerable. You're not going to push them out with the frontline panzers, which means that these guys have no infantry support. That's just pure tanks out there. So at the end of the day, they're sitting there in their tank locker out here somewhere, and this is supposedly, you can see that even this line isn't even solid. It's like maybe there's a couple of tanks here, most of your tanks are here, and the Soviets the next day, realizing this, attack from all sides and surround it. So there's a free-for-all in there. They're knocking out tanks at close range, and the Germans basically have to come back and rejoin the rest of their troops to get out of this trap. So breakthroughs are happening, so that's true, but they're temporary and limited. There's no giant breakthrough where a division is like breaking through to here, getting to Prokhorovka, and there's nothing back here. There's another tank army back here.
And that article mentioned that.
Right.
It mentioned the fact that there were tons of Soviet troops and armor.
Right, right. There's even more behind that. So, you know, this, it's a myth about the breakthrough. But the fact is there are breakthroughs happening. As you can see, even on a map like this, where you can see that the Germans are breaking through here and then have to retreat here. They have to retreat. Soviets are here, here, through here. There's a breakthrough here, but then it stops. These guys are moving down. All of these breakthroughs are very limited in an area where you can always find a gap in the enemy's line and try and exploit it. So what's key there is how you can react to it, whether you can then deploy forces to destroy them now that they've broken through where they're very vulnerable, or whether you just let them run amok until they run out of gas or, you know, run up against other anti-tank forces. Yes?
And can I add something?
Sure.
I don't want to point into your seminar, but I hopefully this kind of emphasizes what you were saying. You were saying something earlier about how the importance of commanders and leadership and personalities on a battle.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot gets mentioned about the day of Prokhorovka, which is the day Rukhmistrov's 5th Guards Tank Army gets committed. And Rukhmistrov had a really bad day.
Oh, yeah.
At Prokhorovka. And I mean, you know, publicly he's a big hero. Privately, Stalin said, "You wrecked my tank army."
Yes.
You know, in one day, he just kind of threw it in this kind of uncoordinated attack and lost a whole bunch of armor. And it was atypical of how the Soviets fought that battle. For the most part, they fought it pretty well. Trotnikov's breakthrough up here really, really gets stopped cold, and they lose a lot of armor in that. And that's the day after Prokhorovka.
Right.
Trotnikov does this big attack across the river, and the Soviets just stop them in their tracks,
right,
and really make them pay a penalty, and don't lose much armor in return. So when the Soviets at this point are on their game, they're doing pretty well. But that one, I think too much emphasis is put on what happens that one day, because Rukhmistrov really screwed a pooch.
And who is writing most of the things we're reading? The Germans again, right?
Yeah.
And I agree completely.
Unless he got his footing, right. I mean, 5th Guards Tank Army wasn't losing tanks like that after that, but he really had a pick.
Well, there's an interesting story about that. As he goes out with his, I don't know, is it chief of staff or somebody that's supposed to be operating one of his mechanized corps, but they go out that next morning for their attack, where they're going to attack, and they just simply drive out in their vehicle, whatever it is, and they go out there and they look in front of them and it's like, why are those guys out there? You know, I did not order them to get on that hill this morning. You know, and he looks at him and he says, "Did you tell your unit to gather? They're German tanks. They're driving right towards a huge group of German tanks." And they realize, oh, crap, you know, the Germans are attacking and we weren't expecting this, which is part of the reason Rukhmistrov does these massive counterattacks, just, you know, throwing his tanks in.
Really uncoordinated.
Yes, very uncoordinated.
Like, it's not like they're fighting most of the rest of the battle.
Right. Kutenkopf is going to get chewed up badly because they're going to coordinate the counterattacks from all sides, and the Germans can't defend against this because all they have is armor, and they have a mix of different armor.
And the Soviets up there use really good combined arms tactics.
Yes. And they plan for a whole day.
To what's been going on down below.
Right.
Up there is armor,
right,
artillery, and infantry really well integrated.
Yes. And again, it's personalities involved, the kind of commanders, whether they're going to get along and work together. It's just amazing. And that's the main reason why most of the divisions and most of the units, if they're similar, like our divisions in World War II, were organized the same way, they were trained the same way, and yet you would have one division do phenomenally well and another division, you know, not do as well. And again, it's the personalities of the commanders and how they utilize their resources, their human resources, their commanders, and whether they motivated them and everything. So, yes, I mean, that's part of the weird thing about any battlefield is that not every counter is exactly the same number. It's almost like it's not a total crapshoot because there's a certain level of competence with all of these guys now. But you can still have a bad day, even if you're a Guards Tank Command, Army commander, and you can have a really good day, even if you're a battalion commander. So, you know, it could be the luck of the draw, or it could be the die. The luck of the, that's why we play the games. Yes. Do you have any other questions? No?
Yeah. What's your favorite mistake that happened in this battle, just in terms of amusing, telling, important blunder that one of these generals or commanders made on the field?
What a commander made as a mistake, or a mistake, some error that was made.
Yeah, just general anecdote that just maybe telling about the mindset that these people had.
That's a really good question. Let me think about that a second. Well, you know, if you go back to the very first map and you look at, this is supposed to be a pincer. Both sides are supposed to be attacking. But if you look at the numbers of tanks available, there's like hundreds more tanks available in the south than there are up here for the Germans. So it's like, if you're trying to achieve something, why do you have such disparate numbers? Why do you have such weaker numbers in the north trying to do the same thing as the south and meet up, not quite halfway, but almost halfway at Kursk? It's like someone isn't planning this to win. Not that they're planning to lose, but there's like this lack of enthusiasm on the German side for this plan. If you can believe Guderian, again, Hitler's dead, he asked Hitler, he said, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do the offensive? And Hitler's like, yeah, you know, every time I think about it, I get sick. Let's assume for a second that he's actually saying the truth. That Hitler's like, you know, this is the best I could come up with. Zeitler's my buddy, but, you know, this isn't the greatest plan in the world, but we don't have anything else. Well, Guderian's not in favor of it. Hitler's less, you know, lukewarm on the whole thing. That just gets transmitted all the way down. This is Model up here who is supposed to do this. Now, usually he's a great defensive general, but it's like, you know, no one really believes in this plan, and it's not like they really want to do it. You know what I mean? There's not this, it's like, there was no rah, rah, rah. Hitler's going to change that when he tries to do the Battle of Bulge. When he tells all of his generals and everything, why are we doing this? He says, we can change this because they're fragile. There's no way that Soviet communists, British imperialists, and American capitalists are going to keep this together. Just like Frederick the Great, who he kept the picture in his office, just like Frederick the Great won, because at the last minute, the coalition against him fell apart because it couldn't last. Ours isn't either. All we need is one strong blow, and the Americans are weak. They're the ones that can't stand the blood. The Russians, you know, we kill another million of them. It doesn't matter. Stalin doesn't care, and his people aren't going to do anything about it. But, you know, we bloody the Americans, and they're going to... He got everyone enthused about it, believing about it in the beginning. And that was not only the propaganda he got his officers into for the Bulge, but it permeated all the way down where guys were talking about, this is it. We're going to have a game-changing difference here with this offensive in the Ardennes. Which is why when it failed and when they lost, there was a huge collapse of morale in the German Western armies, and they started seeing massive desertions and surrenders. Is because when you build people up for something like that and you don't deliver, then you have the opposite effect. So to me, the thing that is the most telling is that, and in a way it's funny, you have the Germans are like, why are we doing this? I don't know. I don't have anything better. Let's just do it. This is their attitude. On the Soviet side, they're planning every little thing they can think of to not only stop them and do pile stuff into this little pocket, but they're planning this huge counteroffensive, and they still don't have any confidence. It's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? The Germans are going to attack. They're going to break through. How are we going to stop them? And the Germans are going, you really want to attack? Nah, I don't want to. Okay, what the hell? Right? So the difference between the two commands and what they're thinking about before this battle is such a huge contrast. And yet, like I said, they're both going to be wrong. But the Soviets could afford to be wrong the way they were wrong, and the Germans, it's fatal to their strategic war aims. Yes, sir?
So given what you said about the Soviet tank armies, you know, kind of basically dissolving once you commit them as they all fall apart, what do you think of Guderian's idea of letting the Russians have the initiative and basically punching themselves dry? Would that have fallen afoul of the fact that the Soviets just had endless numbers of tanks, or do you think it could have worked?
Well, number one, the Germans didn't know they had as many tanks as they had.
Right.
So Guderian is making his suggestion based upon faulty information. If he knew, if the Germans knew how many Soviet tanks and troops they were up against, they'd all be like, you know, really rethinking everything they're doing. But they don't realize that. The Soviets are extremely good at hiding that information from the Germans. But in terms of actual effect, the Soviets have so many forces and could eventually shift them that they're going to be able to attack. It's absolutely going to happen somewhere on the front. The problem is where? And that Guderian could never answer. So, you know, are they going to go down here? Are they going to go up here, the Bryansk, Orel pocket? Are they going to go to Smolensk? Are they going to try and do the, you know, the Operation Bagration, which destroyed Army Group Center and cut off all the Germans in Latvia, Estonia, and so forth? Maybe they're going to try it there. Like I said, the Germans have just bad choices all over the place. But if they did a limited attack for psychological and morale and propaganda purposes, that might have saved their coalition, because the Romanians are already trying to get out of this war. You know, the Germans are not letting them. The Italians have pulled their troops out of Russia. Finland is already really negotiating with the Soviets to get out of the war, because they can see where this is going, and they make a good deal for themselves. But if Germany's trying to keep this together, you just... What, Anne?
No, I was just going to ask, where did the Soviets have the best chance, you think?
Oh, where would they do the most damage?
Yeah, what do you think would be their best option?
Okay, so there's a place down here called Nikopol, which is like the largest nickel-producing mine on the planet. And the Germans, these resources, in fact, when you ask Hitler and you look at all his speeches and everything else, he's always emphasizing, like, Stalingrad has so much shipping go through, it has so much factory production. And so if you look at it from an economic standpoint and what they need for resources, the Germans need to keep a buffer away from their factories down here. And they need to keep the Soviets away, not only from the ground, but from air attacks. And Nikopol and some of the other mining areas are down in this area. So the most damage the Soviets could do is to try and destroy Army Group South, launch toward Kiev or towards Romania. And the Germans, for this, of course, they'd gathered their tank forces there, and they could have done a lot of damage. But the problem that the Germans have is they can't cover the front. They can't. It's just physically impossible for them to cover every inch of the front, which means that the Soviets can use their numbers. Okay, so this tank army gets chewed up, but the one next to it is probably going to go 300 miles. Okay? And that's the other difference, is that it's like Frank was saying, is that even when they had nobody in front of them, their army's running out of tanks. So that's not happening here. Plus, the other factor is, okay, well, the tanks aren't breaking down, but don't they outrun their fuel? Ah, what is happening with those Lend-Lease trucks? By this time of the war, the Americans have delivered 90,000, basically, deuce and a halfs, okay? That's not huge, because that's going to grow to a 500,000. But this is, they've finally got a pretty good load of trucks, and that's going to help sustain the Soviet offensive so that they're going to be able to basically get all the way to here, okay, in their counteroffensive. And that is something they were not able to do the prior years, okay, just because of the logistics capability that they had added. So it's a very long explanation, but one of the things Hitler said that I think he's dead right about is that if we only do defensive things, we're going to inevitably lose. You have to attack. You have to do offensive things. You have to carry the war to the enemy. You have to destroy them and also capture their territory, their war-making capability, if you have any intention of winning. Because the inevitable result of defense is you lose, because you've surrendered the initiative to the enemy. He's going to be able to pick and choose. And this is the irony, is that even though we know that defense is stronger, so you have to have 3-1, 5-1 odds against a defender, strategically, defense is terrible, because you have to have a lot of troops and a lot of forces to parry whatever the enemy is going to do. So in Stalingrad, as an example, which is another battle that I've studied a lot, the irony is that it sucked up a huge number of Soviet troops who also were destroyed in the city fighting. You think, well, that's a very strong defensive position. Yes, but in order to defend, say, a city block that's crossed by multiple streets, you have to set up your machine guns to cover every street. In the open, say the open terrain of the steppe, maybe 2 or 3 machine guns could cover, you know, several hundred yards. But in a city, because you've got like an alley, and then you've got a street, and then you've got a side street, you have to have machine gun positions covering all those for the potential where the enemy could come through. So you actually need more troops and more defenders to protect an area like that than you do in the open. So that's another example of defense where you have to have a lot more troops, and I think the same thing is true on the whole front. Wherever the Soviets were going to attack, they would be able to find some place the Germans weren't, because the Germans simply don't have enough troops, enough mobile troops, or enough things to parry whatever thrust. They're going to lose territory. What the Germans did not realize is that the Soviets are so strong that if they had not destroyed nearly 2,000 tanks at Kursk, they would have had those 2,000 tanks and the 3,000 more on top of it when they did their offensive, and they'd have those to basically attack with. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Okay, well, it's probably better perhaps for Monday, but just looking at the Russians and the Germans going on a one-front war, do you think the Germans had any chance?
Oh, you mean if the Germans only had to concentrate against? Well, there's several different alternate histories about this. One is that not everyone in the United States was gung-ho to give the Soviets anything they wanted. Okay, the argument that won over a lot of anti-communist senators and others who didn't want to just give them everything that we had, okay? Well, the argument that won is, we can either have the Russians get killed or we can have American boys get killed, okay? Someone's going to die in this war, better the commies, right? So give them everything they end to keep them in the war, to keep them fighting, and if it takes, you know, our tanks and our airplanes and everything like that, you know, that's fine. Better them than us. But what if that lobby, that anti-communist lobby, said, you know what, screw the Russians. Let the Germans and the Russians beat each other to death. In fact, let the German army be halfway into Russia, because then it's not facing us, right? So, I mean, it is possible that, and what difference would that have made? We not only gave them the things I talked about, but we gave them an entire oil refinery that was designed to make high-octane aviation fuel. Here it is. Here's everything. We'll reassemble it, put it in your country, which, of course, they used in the Cold War. But the point is that we were willing to give them lots of things except the atomic bomb, just about everything up to and including. If we wanted to limit them, all we had to do is not give them trucks, for example. Okay, the weapons, we could give them tanks and other things. But again, as we pointed out several times, the logistics is the thing that's limiting you. So and also fuel. Once the Germans did their 1942 offensive, they got near the oil fields, they did capture several, and they disrupted the oil flow inside of the Soviet Union. So it was not huge numbers, but again, anything that changes, especially, and this is very important, 42 and 40 and late 41, what we were sending them was essential for them to rebound and also hold the Germans. What would have happened had our guys had a bigger fight about Lend-Lease? What if they said, okay, we'll do it, but it took 6 months more or 3 months more of fighting in the Senate of the House to decide to do that? That we didn't start that huge flow going to Russia immediately to give them whatever they needed. What if they didn't get that stuff through the winter of 41? What if they didn't get all these things that we sent them in 42? Or not as much or not as quickly? Would that have changed things? Well, they only were able to do two counteroffensives in 42, one at Moscow called Mars, Operation Mars, and Operation Uranus at Stalingrad. Stalingrad succeeded and Mars didn't. So if the Lend-Lease had limited them and you take away one of those attacks, they can only do one instead of two, and they had done Mars, which failed, then there is no Stalingrad. There is no huge success in 42, which means the Germans are still deep into Russia. Does that change the war? A lot of people said, if the Germans beat Russia, their prize, their real prize, is a nuclear bomb on Berlin. Okay, that's it. Because when we develop the nuclear bombs, where are they going to go? Our policy was Germany first. And although there's been claims that the reason we did it against the Japanese was partly racist, it was, no, we're going to end this war. And I truly believe that if we had the atomic bomb and Germany was still fighting, we were going to drop it on Germany. So one way or another, Germany's going down.